genre。
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Protagonist Podcast, where each week we look at a great character and a great story. I'm Joe Dorowski, and this week we're discussing Sec Unit from All Systems Red, the first novella in the Murderbot Diaries by Martha Wells. And joining me for the discussion is returning guest Kirsta Christensen. Welcome back, Kirsta.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
This was one of the stranger character names and book titles that I've had to put in here. Sec Unit from Murderbot Diaries. So for any listeners who are not familiar, All Systems Red was published on May 2nd, 2017 and tells the story of a part human, part robot security unit called a SEC unit. This SEC unit is assigned to protect a group of humans who are performing a study on an alien planet. He has disabled his governor that is supposed to limit his agency and the development of anything less than robotic obedience to orders and guidelines set by some monolithic capitalist company that has allowed the SEC unit to be rented out to these humans. Now, the SEC unit prefers to spend its time watching episodes of a long-running soap opera, but then finds itself in an emergency survival situation where it must choose whether to protect these humans or not. For me,
good times.
The part that grabs me is the SEC unit just wanting to watch a long-running soap opera. That is fantastic.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Like, once that was coming up, I was I'm all in on this story.
Yes.
This robot thing is emotionally invested in this telenovela, essentially.
Yes.
All right.
No, it's a very different take.
about what brings like emotional depth and humanity to technology. It's a telenovela. Mm-hmm. So, Kirsta, absolutely. This is another text that I came to because you asked if we could cover it. I was not familiar with it. I had not listened to it. It is available as an audiobook on Audible for free. If you just have an Audible account, this is one of the ones that you can go listen to, at least the novella. I think the series goes on, and you'd have to use some credits for some of the later novels that have been written. But for this first novella, you just go listen to it, and I enjoyed the performance. It's a good narrator that they have. And it's definitely a story that it's one of those, like, it quickly became like a compulsive listen where it's like, I've got 10 minutes. I can listen to the next 10 minutes of this.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yes.
So another excellent recommendation from Kirsta. How did you come to it, though?
Yeah. So it was kind of word of mouth for me. I'd heard it mentioned, the series, the Murderbot Diaries, mentioned in just a few circles that I, you know, like Discords and Facebook and various things, always people saying like, oh my gosh, I love this series so much. And it was people who had similar tastes to me. And then I saw this book had won, you know, Hugo and Nebula's. And I mean, the name Murderbot might have been a turnoff because I don't tend to do like violent sci-fi, but it was also pretty clear that like that was not actually representative, you know, based on the other taste that people had. It was clear that wasn't really representative of the story. So and I had just gotten into audiobooks in part to have something to listen to while I was trying to fall asleep, so I just wasn't on my phone all the time, and it was a novella, so I was like, okay, that might be good for an audiobook. So yeah, like you, I initially came to it on audio, and it was just like so charming, and the voice is so funny, and I just ended up binging the whole thing. So I've listened to, I think there are 7 books in the series, 6 of those are novellas, so they're mostly novellas. There's 1 full length novel, and then a couple of short stories that are sort of ancillary to it. Like, you don't have to read the short stories to know what's going on, but it's just a fun little chunk if you're interested in those. And and I've listened to them over and over again, which sometimes I feel bad about, like, shouldn't I break out and try something new? But Murderbot itself also likes to watch its favorite TV shows over and over again. So I feel like Murderbot would be understanding of why I want to keep listening to familiar, comforting things when I'm feeling stressed out.
Yes. And I fully intend to like keep going with the series. I haven't had time yet, but I read that like the first four novellas are pretty much one complete series, you know, storyline. Like this feels satisfying. Having listened to this full thing, like if there was no more Murderbot stories, I still would have enjoyed this one. But knowing that there is like an immediate continuation of the story, it's something that I'm definitely going to go track down.
Yeah. The first one is probably the most self-contained. But there's a character in the second one who's my favorite character of the whole series. So yeah,
I think that's exciting. Okay. I will have to go listen to the second one as soon as I can then. So let's see. Martha Wells has written, I have it down as 5 novellas, 3 short stories, and 2 novels. You mentioned 1 novel, but according to Wikipedia, the most recent entry in the series was a novel that was published in November of last year.
I thought that was a novella, but I'd have to check the length. And again, I'm listening to them on audiobook, so I don't have a feel for the page count.
Yeah. Wikipedia lists it as a full length novel, but who knows? It's Wikipedia. Anyone can edit that. I do rely on it an awful lot, though. So please, no one go mess around with Wikipedia. Just let's keep the facts there.
Right.
You mentioned that this was an award-winning series. It has won Hugo, Nebula, and Locus Awards, and also an award from the American Library Association. So it does have a very strong reputation within the sci-fi community, and it just seems to be very popular. As soon as I looked into it, I was kind of like surprised that it hadn't pinged on my radar yet. So I was very glad that you suggested it because it feels like something I should have already been aware of. I always, on the one hand, like there's too much media, so there's things I'm not aware of, but it's also I think a little bit exciting when there's something that's like I should have known about this because it is in my wheelhouse and now I've just become aware of it, and there's already 4-5 novellas and 2 novels. Like I can go dig into this whole thing.
Yes.
And maybe
it's always a lovely feeling. Oh, sorry. As much as we try to stay on top of things, as much as it's fun to try and stay on top of things, it's also always lovely to discover something that you've missed, you know, something that a gem from a few years ago that kind of pops up and then it's perfect for you.
Mm-hmm. And I would have become more aware of it because I'm sure there'll be a big push when the TV series that's being adapted from the series comes out. So that is going to be on Apple Plus. Alexander Skarsgård is set to star. And it's been fully cast, so it seems to be in production now, but I couldn't find a release date that had been announced. But it does seem like a full Murderbot series is going to happen with the level of casting and all the other news that I was able to track down about it.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see how they address it because like Alexander Skarsgård is set to start it, so that's already made a choice where, in at least in this first novella, it makes it pretty clear there's supposed to be no gender to the sec unit. It is human parts and robot parts, but not like a human who had robot parts added on is the situation I was given in the first novella. Maybe we find out more about the origins of these sec units in future, stories.
It's also a very interior story. And I will be curious to know how they choose to adapt that to a television show. At this point, I honestly don't know how they could possibly do it without a voiceover, which feels a little cliche, but, you know, it's a technique that exists for a reason. And maybe they won't do that, but I will be very curious to know how they adapt it because so much of it is its voice, its internal voice, and like translating that to the screen could be tricky.
Yeah, it's one of those things when we talk about adaptation, like one of the absolute strengths of the novel format is that interiority where you can be inside of the characters. And that is something that does not translate to stage or film nearly as intuitively and easily as it exists on the page in novels. There are things that, you know, stage plays or films can do that are their own strengths that are completely different than what the novel has. But this novel is leaning so much into that strength and affordance of novel writing that it actually is going to be a pretty significant translation into the other medium. And because it's called Murderbot Diaries and we are so familiar with robot and sci-fi stuff on screen, it feels like, oh, well, of course, like this was probably written as a pitch for a TV show. It could almost feel like just based on the title and even the premise that we've talked through a little bit. But you're completely right in what you say about the novel is based on like his thought process and or his, you know, the sec unit's thought process and like choosing between these different paths and us reading the ruminations about, well, should I do this or that? And I really would rather just do this. And that isn't a very natural presentation of narrative on screen.
Yeah. Yeah. And I am supportive of when people try something new or different, either in an original work or in an adaptation. And so I can see them doing something very different and being successful at it. And I'm not really someone who, I mean, certainly there are adaptations that have disappointed me because I love the source material, but I'm not really someone who's like, oh, if it's too different, it's just not good, right? Mm-hmm. But I feel like there are also a lot of ways that they could fail because of what the novella is doing could be very difficult to put onto screen. So, you know, I'm hopeful they'll succeed. I'm hopeful it'll be great. I'm hopeful it'll be its own thing that's really fun that doesn't undermine or undercut the source material. But I'm also wary because I can see a lot of pitfalls.
Yeah, like it should feel different to watch, particularly like this kind of story on screen versus reading it. If they're going to lean into the strengths of television storytelling, it will be a completely different feeling and, you know, to the novel. And that can be frustrating because so much of what we love about the novel is that interiority. But, you know, like the immediate thing is like the action sequences on screen are just going to feel viscerally different than the action sequences that are described on, you know, on the page. Like what this, one of the first things is like this alien creature that comes up, and I didn't even really get a picture in my head, like the way it was described on page of like what this alien creature that comes burrowing out of the ground. I didn't picture like a sand dune worm or, you know, I have no idea what that creature looks like. They are going to have to make very concrete choices about what that creature looks like. And if they do it well, it could be a much more exciting sequence than what existed in the novel. But also, what are we going to lose? We're going to lose some things that we do love about the novel. And I think there can be some, it can be a frustrating thing to like get hung up on fidelity and to have fans that reject any adaptation because it's not perfectly faithful, because any adapter has to make choices. That is the nature of adaptation. It cannot be this direct beat for beat of what was on the page to the screen. It seems sometimes that's what fans demand, and sometimes texts or adaptations fail because they are too faithful. They're not allowing the strengths of the new medium to tell the story because there's this fear or trepidation about deviating from what made the story popular in the first place. I imagine we're gonna see all sorts of almost like a, you know, Tony Stark in the helmet kind of screenshots of like what is the sec unit's point of view, with lots of like images. And like if you pause it and look around, there's probably gonna be lots of jokes about like having a video file running in the background and it's the telenovela that he loves, you know, all these other things that could happen. But that's one way that I'm sure they're gonna convey some of the interior, or at least I would expect. I can't say I'm sure, but that's one thing that I would immediately expect.
Right.
But it's also not going to be the same as hearing the thoughts.
I mean, either they'll have to, you know, resort to very literal storytelling devices like voiceovers, as I said, or the tone is really going to change, or both, or neither. And adaptations are always interesting, and it's fun to see what's coming up. I think I have more trepidation about this particular adaptation than I have a lot of adaptations recently, just because I think it is going to be difficult to translate it. But at the same time, I'm also really excited to see what they're going to do. So, you know, we'll see when it shows up.
All right. Well, before we move on to the full summary of this story, listeners, we want to thank you for downloading this episode and for listening. And we especially want to thank those of you who support us on Patreon. If you'd like to support us financially, we invite you to go to patreon.com/protagonists and support our show with at least $1 per month. All supporters on Patreon at any level receive access to our monthly quick casts, which are shorter episodes in which we talk about the media that we are consuming that we are not yet covering as full episodes of the podcast. We also give updates on the fantasy box office for 2024. And all patrons who support us with $5 per month or more get to choose a topic for us to discuss. Kirsten, you were kind enough to write the summary for this novella, so I will turn the time over to you.
All right. So what I actually want to do is just read the first paragraph of this book to start with, because it does such a great job of introducing the tone of the novel. So it starts out, "I could have become a mass murderer after I hacked my governor module, but then I realized I could access the combined feed of entertainment channels carried on the company satellites. It had been well over 35,000 hours or so since then, with still not much murdering, but probably, I don't know, a little under 35,000 hours of movies, serials, books, plays, and music consumed. As a heartless killing machine, I was a terrible failure." And I, you know, I'm someone who's very interested in world building, and I always love, like, the way a story starts. And so I even wrote down, like, what do we learn just from this paragraph? Okay, we're in a science fiction setting. We are reading a story about some kind of non-human manufactured intelligence. This machine has some kind of restraint in place so that it doesn't hurt people. It has a governor module, which implies that the possibility of violent behavior is an actual concern of whoever built this machine. But this machine has hacked its own governor module, and instead of going rogue, it has devoted its time to watching TV and other media. And this story is written in the first person in a very sarcastic and self-aware voice. So that's, you know, that drops us in. And I love, I think it's easy to overlook how much setup is going on in something like that. But it's just it's a home run of a first paragraph. I'm also going to take the time to explain some back information, some world information that's just going to be easier to explain up front before I go into the main summary. So there are four kinds of intelligent people or creatures in this universe. There are humans, there are augmented humans, there are constructs, and there are bots. So humans are just regular humans. We are in a science fiction world, but there's no indication that these humans are biologically different from us. And notably, this story is not set in a Star Trek type universe where humans are constantly interacting with other humanoid aliens. So there are no rubber forehead aliens, there are no other kinds of aliens. Just humans. The second group is augmented humans. And augmented humans are humans that have some kind of artificial implant that allows them to do things that they couldn't otherwise do. So they can process large amounts of data, or they can directly control a drone with their brains. However, augmented humans are still born human, and getting a neurological augment is portrayed as a choice. They're not super, super rare. Based on the whole series, I would estimate maybe 5 or 10% of the population is augmented. So they're not, you know, incredibly rare, but they're also not the majority by far. And then I'm going to skip over constructs and talk about bots. Bots are robots. They are entirely inorganic. They can be humanoid in form, but most of the ones we encounter in the Corporation Rim, where the story is set, are designed for a more specific purpose. So there are hauler bots in mines, there are cargo transport bots on space stations, there are ships with bot pilots, and non-humanoid bots are intelligent, but they don't always use words to communicate. So the bot pilots communicate using images instead. Okay, so constructs. Constructs can pass as humans. Murderbot/SecUnit is a construct, but they are actually built from cloned human and then inorganic or robotic parts. So they're partially organic, partially robotic, and notably, they are not first born human and then made into constructs. So they are always what they are from the time that they're built. And they have human intelligence and judgment and decision-making skills, but they also have superhuman abilities like speed and strength and data processing and hacking skills, and also the ability to heal from very severe injuries. And even their organic parts don't quite work like human parts. So at some point, Murderbot mentions that it has self-sealing blood vessels, which is obviously not something that humans have. The construct we're following is a security unit, or SEC unit, which is designed to provide defensive security to teams of humans, and constructs are not considered people, and they do not have human rights. So, Our main character is a SEC unit who has been rented out to a team that is surveying a section of an uninhabited planet to see if they want to build on some of the natural resource rights. In order to do a survey of the planet, they need a bunch of equipment and an insurance bond. And in order to get the insurance bond, they have to rent a SEC unit who's programmed to keep them safe and generally advise them against doing stupid things. In the Corporation Rim, this is a pretty common situation. The Corporation Rim is a capitalist dystopia. It's full of competing companies whose only goal is to make money, so they constantly overcharge their customers while simultaneously trying to provide them with shoddy merchandise. So this is the inverse of the utopian federation in Star Trek. However, this particular survey team is not from the Corporation Rim. They're from an outside region called the Preservation Alliance that has a more socialist approach to life. But non-Corporation Rim planets also have a reputation in the Corporation Rim of being terrible backwaters that no one would be interested in anyway, so they just don't have a lot of capital, a lot of social capital. Because they're not from the Corporation Rim, they're not used to working with SEC units, and they try to get out of having to rent one for their contract. However, no company in the Corporation Rim will let them do the survey without the insurance bond, and the insurance bond requires a SEC unit, so they have to accept it as part of the contract, but they're very unhappy about the situation and uncomfortable around the SEC unit. This SEC unit calls itself Murderbot for reasons we will explain later. Note, as you said earlier, SEC units do not have any gender or sex. Murderbot refers to itself as it, and I will do the same. When we first meet Murderbot, it is accompanying members of the Preservation Survey team out on a land survey of an uninhabited planet. This is a pretty routine assignment, and Murderbot is kind of bored and not really giving the situation its full attention. Suddenly, a giant animal of some kind bursts out of nowhere and attacks two of the preservation scientists who are at the bottom of a crater. Murderbot jumps down into the crater and shoots the giant animal, rescuing one of the team members, Dr. Bard Waj, from its jaws. She's been seriously injured, so Murderbot needs to get her back to the medical suite at their base. The other scientist, Dr. Valescu, is physically unharmed, but he's in shock. Murderbot needs both of its arms to carry Dr. Bard Waj back to the team's vehicle, but it also needs to get Dr. Valescu safely back as well. It retracts the helmet of its body armor so that Dr. Valescu can see its face and begins to calmly give him instructions to follow it out of the crater. This does the trick, and everyone makes it up and back to the vehicle. The team lands at the base and safely delivers Dr. Bard Waj to the medical system. Murderbot heads to its own repair cubicle, which will allow it to regrow its organic parts that were damaged in the attack. It's just getting ready to go into stasis when there's a knock on the door. Dr. Mensa, the head of the survey team, has stopped by to see how Murderbot is doing since she knows it sustained damage. This is pretty unusual behavior for human clients who tend not to notice or care how their SEC units are doing. However, these human clients are not from the Corporation Rim, and so they don't have as much experience working with SEC units, which also means they don't really take it for granted in the same way. Dr. Mensa also compliments Murderbot on its handling of Dr. Valescu's shock, since the automated med system was focusing just on the more critically injured Dr. Bard Waj. Murderbot shrugs off the compliment, saying that calming victims is part of its emergency protocols. Dr. Mensa leaves, and Murderbot goes into repair mode. And this is one of the first hints we have that Murderbot is actually very, very good at its job, even though so much of its job has been kind of programmed into it. It still has superior judgment and decision-making skills, you know, even above and beyond that. And Dr. Mensa noticed. Oh, and they're all scientists, so they're all Dr. this and that, which I guess we still have PhDs in the future. That's fine. Murderbot is very uncomfortable when interacting with Dr. Mensa. Although it is extremely good at its job, which basically involves rescuing humans from their own stupidity, Murderbot doesn't like interacting with humans directly, especially when it's not wearing armor or an opaque helmet. It's uncomfortable making eye contact, and it feels like it doesn't always know the appropriate way to respond in human conversation. Its presence clearly makes most humans uncomfortable, and it, in turn, can't trust humans because humans can order it to do things that are stupid or dangerous. And even though Murderbot doesn't technically have to follow those orders anymore, if it reveals that its governor module is no longer functional, that would put it at even greater risk. When Murderbot is finished with its repairs, Dr. Mensa asks it to report to her. The attack from the unknown animal not only put a team member in danger, but according to their preliminary information packet, there shouldn't have been any large fauna on the planet at all, let alone dangerous large fauna. When Murderbot arrives, it finds Mensa with the rest of the crew who are going over the information packet, trying to figure out why the data about the dangerous animals is missing from the report. Moonfrot didn't have time to clean and repair its armor before reporting to Dr. Mensa, so instead it's wearing a human-style uniform. This startles one of the other team members, who doesn't recognize it out of its armor, which just adds more awkwardness to the situation. Moonfrot helps the team analyze the information packet and confirms, to its surprise, that some sections of the package appear to have been deleted, including the section that would have warned them about dangerous fauna. However, it's unclear if this is some kind of glitch or if it's deliberate sabotage, and if it's sabotage, who would be behind it? There is one other survey team on this planet called Deltfall. They're located far enough away that Preservation Team has never met them, but Preservation decides to contact them to see if they can supply the missing packet data, and Deltfall, when contacted, agrees to do that. In the meantime, Preservation has identified a nearby location whose mapping data is missing from the packet, so they make a plan to go visit the location to see what is actually there, to see if someone's maybe trying to hide something. In an effort to be friendly, one of the Preservation Team members invites Murderbot to hang out with them in the crew quarters instead of in his cubicle. This is the last thing that Murderbot wants, and it looks so appalled that Dr. Mensa quickly adds, "Or not, whatever you like, you don't have to." Next day, part of the team sets out with Murderbot to survey the location with missing map data. Everyone on the team is politely giving Murderbot a lot of space, so Murderbot searches reviews the security video and sees that they had a group discussion about how best to treat it going forward. At least one person wants to talk to it about its feelings, but luckily Dr. Mensa overrides that suggestion. On the way to the new location, the autopilot glitches off, but luckily Dr. Mensa has been flying the vehicle manually, so there's no problem. When they get to the location, they don't see anything obviously unusual, although when they walk around, they keep accidentally heading towards hazardous areas. It seems to be due to a glitch in their mapping scanners, which lends credence to the theory that the missing packet info is also just due to some sort of glitch. However, when they get back to their base, they discover a new and troubling issue. They can't contact Deltfall. Deltfall is on the other side of the planet, but Preservation has a large vehicle that can make it there and back without recharging. Preservation is hoping that Deltfall has just had some sort of communications outage, but they also want to be prepared for the worst and offer help if they can. They prepare to fly all night to the Deltfall base, and everyone takes turns as pilot and co-pilot. While Murderbot isn't flying, one of the team members, Rati, tries to talk to it about whether or not SEC units have feelings. Another crew member, Oversay, gets mad at Rati for bringing that up, to which Rati angrily replies that it's basically slavery, the existence of SEC units. Murderbot knows that Dr. Mensa has told them not to ask it personal questions, so Murderbot sends the audio to Dr. Mensa in the pilot seat, and she gets mad at Rati. Murderbot gets up and moves to face the wall and another part of the vehicle to calm down. Rati offers to apologize, but Dr. Mensa tells him to just leave the SEC unit alone.
Just leave this poor being alone.
Yes, yes, yes. It's like making things worse by trying to make things better. As they continue traveling to Deltfall, the planet's communication satellite suddenly goes down, cutting them off from their own base. They decide to continue on with their plan, but they're clearly worried about the whole situation. When they get to Deltfall, the base is eerily quiet. Murderbot volunteers to go in alone because it's worried that it might not be safe for the humans. It relays what it's seeing on its cameras to the other human as it prepares to enter the habitat. The first thing it finds is one of their SEC units dead with a huge hole in its chest. Then it starts to find human bodies also killed. Murderbot knows that Deltfall base had 3 total SEC units, so it assumes that the other SEC units must have gone rogue for some reason and attacked the humans. It locates and disables the other 2 SEC units, but then it gets knocked out. When it regains consciousness, it has strange sensations. It's been wounded and something has removed its helmet and part of its armor. It attacks the 4th SEC unit, who shouldn't be there, who removed Murderbot's helmet, but then a 5th SEC unit shows up in the doorway. It, however, suddenly falls down, having been disabled by Dr. Mensa, who did enter the habitat and is behind it and holding a large sonic mining drill. Another Preservation team member helps Murderbot get back to the vehicle. Murderbot is still feeling odd when it suddenly realizes why the 4th SEC unit had removed its helmet. Murderbot reaches to the back of its neck and realizes that the 4th SEC unit had installed a combat override module into its data port, which could force it to attack its own humans, and which is probably why the Deltfall humans were killed by their own SEC units. Murderbot begins to shout to Dr. Mensa that she needs to kill it to save them, but they don't understand in time, so it grabs a hand weapon and disables itself by shooting itself in the chest. However, it disables itself, it doesn't kill itself. So Murderbot begins to raise consciousness, does a self-diagnostic, and finds itself on, on a bed in the medical suite, and discovers that the Preservation team has been able to remove the combat override module. Murderbot's hearing comes back online, and it begins to listen to the Preservation team talking about it. They've been able to remove the module, but in the process, they ran a full diagnostic on their SEC unit, and they've discovered that it has disabled its governor module. One team member, Garothan, is suspicious and thinks that this must be part of the sabotage. However, another team member points out that, according to their analysis, it has had a disabled governor module the entire time, even when it saved the lives of the two team members attacked by the animal in the beginning. Murderbot lets them know that it's awake. Garothan also accuses it of having killed team members on a previous job. Murderbot angrily acknowledges that this is true, but its memory was partially purged after this event, so it doesn't actually know everything that happened in the situation. Incidentally, this is why it refers to itself as Murderbot. After that event, it hacked its own governor module so that it could never happen again, because it assumes something must have gone wrong with its governor module in the first place. Preservation decides to continue working with Murderbot and to trust it over Garothan's objections, and they promise they won't reveal its secret. They eventually figure out that there must be a third survey team on the planet whose presence was hidden from the first two teams. That team has sabotaged the other two teams because it wants exclusive access to some part of the planet, which contains resources that would be illegal to mine under normal circumstances. And I'm going quite quickly through this part, so it takes a while to figure this all out.
Yeah, so it would be illegal to mine. Like, this is the drawing room scene where like the detective explains what's actually been going on.
Yes. So they want to, the planet contains resources that would be illegal to mine under normal circumstances, but that could fetch a fortune on the black market. Murderbot and the preservation team concoct a plan which involves luring the third survey team to preservation's habitat and then switching out Murderbot with one of their own SEC units. They are eventually successful, although Murderbot is seriously injured and goes offline again. When it regains consciousness, it's in a repair cubicle back at the company headquarters. Its memory hasn't been wiped, and its governor module hasn't been re-enabled, both of which imply that the preservation team kept their word and didn't reveal its secret. When its repairs are finished, Murderbot leaves the cubicle and is surprised to see Rati, one of the preservation survey members, who tells him that Dr. Mensa has purchased its contract and it is now going to accompany the preservation team back home. So it won't have to be rented out as a SEC unit anymore. Murderbot is bewildered by this information. People don't typically adopt their pet SEC unit after the end of the contract. The company that previously owned Murderbot is also concerned they haven't had a chance to wipe its memory before the handoff, but Preservation insists that they don't want its memory wiped. Clearly they want their SEC unit, who they've gotten to know as a person that they trust and care for. Murderbot goes to the Preservation team's quarters on the space station, bewildered. Everyone seems excited for it, for its new life, but Murderbot doesn't really know if it wants to live on a planet with lots of other people. Bots, and by extension constructs, have some limited rights on preservation, but Dr. Mensa would still be its legal guardian, which kind of feels like an owner. Murderbot waits until the middle of the sleep cycle, then leaves the rooms. On the space station, it passes itself off as another human and finds a bot-driven cargo ship with no crew that's about to leave on a scheduled run. Murderbot asks if it can hitch a ride. Murderbot has left a goodbye note to Dr. Mensa, who it calls its favorite human. As the cargo ship leaves the space station, Murderbot is with it, leaving the corporation room.
Oh, thank you for writing that summary. Like I said, I really did enjoy this novella, and I think it maintains an excellent balance of entertaining action and like humor and character-driven humor in terms of the SEC unit, but then also raising like critiques about capitalism and environmentalism and greed and what it means to be human and like we're on the cusp of dealing with all sorts of AI issues, you know, in our world, which is definitely a playground that has been well, you know, used in science fiction for decades. But it does feel like a little more current to have, you know, read this novella in, you know, the age of ChatGPT and all these other AI things that we're starting to like wrestle with, like what are the ethics of you know, of using these, of creating these, and you know, not always smoothly handling the ethics of those particular situations, but it's something that we're starting to wrestle with in real life instead of just in sci-fi novels.
That reminds me, I heard or saw some news story, and this was several years ago, so this was pre-ChatGPT, but someone was saying like, oh, you know, within the next few years, we're going to end up creating artificial intelligence, you know, an artificial intelligence that has human intelligence, which that's debatable. But they said, yeah, we're gonna create an artificial intelligence that has human intelligence. And no one has thought about the ethics of this situation. And I thought, have you read any science fiction ever? Like, we have been thinking about the ethics of artificial intelligence for decades, for almost a century. Like, yeah, what is wrong with
a century at this point?
Yes.
like we knew we were going to get here. Like, this has been something that has been anticipated. And this is why we need the humanities as well as STEM, everyone.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Well, and you know, and even situations that we're definitely not going to get to, because, like, you know, what if your identical twin goes through a black hole and then comes back and is not your identical twin anymore? I mean, that's not an issue that we're actually going to run into anytime soon, but it's still reflective of or indicative of other issues of, you know, humanity and personhood and ethics. Like, anyway, yes, you and I, we are preaching to each other's choir, but we are definitely pro-humanities.
I assume many of our listeners are as well. I don't think we're having to convert anyone on this particular point of view. If you're what is this, 490 episodes into the Protagonist podcast.
This is the last straw.
Yes. I'm not making it to 500. They were too pro humanities in the Murderbot episode. And
one thing that
I just want to say, one part of this that struck me as living the dream was being able to do your job while consuming media constantly in the background. I'm like, oh man, you know what? I kind of get Murderbot's point of view here.
Oh my goodness. There's also, it didn't make it into the summary, but there's also a very funny scene. I have to see if I can find it where they, you know, they've it's been disabled. They've done the survey. They've realized that, that it's disabled as governor module, and they also realize it's been downloading tons and tons of media, and they can't figure out why. And one person is like, well, you know, it must be like sending information encoded in the media or something. Like, it can't actually be watching the media. I'll just read the section. It says, then Valescu said, Garothan, you wanted to know how it spends its time. That was what you were originally looking for in its logs. Tell them. Mensa lifted her brows. Well? Garothan hesitated. It's downloaded 700 hours of entertainment programming since we landed. Mostly serials. Mostly something called Sanctuary Moon. He shook his head, dismissing it. It's probably using it to encode data for the company. It can't be watching it. Not at that volume. We'd notice. I snorted. He'd underestimated me. Rati said, the one where the colony's solicitor killed the terraforming supervisor who was the secondary donor for her implanted baby? Again, I couldn't help it. I said, she didn't kill him. That's a lie. Rati turned to Mensa. It's watching it. And I love that trap of, like, you know, if you take someone's favorite show and then bring up like some controversial fan point, they're like, no, that's not what happened.
No, that very scene stuck out to me when I was listening to it. And so I'm so glad that you brought it up and you actually read it, because I'm sure I could not have done it justice in trying to recreate it. But it stands out as such as both a great character point, but also it reveals that Martha Wells, like, understands fandom. like whether it is she is plugged into a fandom herself, or she has seen fandom about her own writing and seen like inane internet arguments about random things, but she knows fandom. That is an author that is not an outsider looking in. That is someone who has experienced these kinds of debates and moments.
And you know how invested you get, and you know, over the course of the series of novellas and the novels, you know, how much Murderbot learns about humanity from the serials, is an issue, and you know, are the serials why it kind of learns to care about people? But then, like, why does it prefer serials over regular humans? And there's also kind of a funny recurring bit where it has a really hard time gauging ages, because in the real world, people age naturally. And on the serials, everyone looks perfect and beautiful all the time. And so it's like, I don't know how old anyone is because they don't look like they look on TV. So, you know, like in our world, high schoolers are inevitably 25 to 30 years old on television just because it's easier to cast them. And what if you thought that was genuinely what high schoolers looked like because, you know, that was your experience of the world?
So I was recently watching a documentary about Superman, and it was mentioning Smallville, that Tom Welling was cast as high school age Clark Kent when he was 24. Huh. The series at first is ambiguous what year of high school he's in. He's just a high school student, but they do full four seasons of him in high school, which means he was supposed to be a freshman when he was 24, and he's 28 as a senior. That's like, wait.
And he was a male model when he was cast. He was he was not a scrawny 24-year-old. He was a unusually muscled 24-year-old who did not look 14 at all.
Yeah. One thing we mentioned, the adaptation. We mentioned that there's going to be an adaptation. Mm-hmm. One thing that I do look forward to is that I will be very disappointed if the adaptation does not give us many scenes of Sanctuary Moon. Like, I want to see this telenovela in much more detail than what we've been given in the novella.
Right. Or, you know, or maybe we only ever hear it, like Murderbot's watching it, but we just hear it and it just gets like more and more ridiculous off stage.
Yeah, and it's just like maudlin and you know, hyperbolic emotions and
and especially, you know, especially what you can do in a science fiction world and a soap opera world where it's like, you know, the secondary clone donor of your whatever, you know, you could, you all of the tangled human relationships can go a level deeper when you have science fiction premise as well.
Like anytime like Murderbot is like going back to his quarters, like I immediately want it to like show him like close his eye or them to it to close its eyes. And then immediately we see a random scene from the telenovela and Murderbot just smiling a little bit as the telenovela starts to play.
Yeah. There's a scene in a later book, and this won't be a spoiler at all, but when Murderbot is having conversation with someone and is kind of getting stressed out, and so and in this world you can have kind of, they're like private chats with people, and so you can be like physically talking to someone but also be like chatting with people behind the scenes, and so it's in this very stressful situation, but it's also on a chat with someone else who's monitoring it, and the person on the chat starts to play the theme music from Sanctuary Moon to calm it down a little bit. And it's like, oh, that actually helps. Okay. And it's just such a sweet moment of like, I know you're stressed out. I don't know what to do. Here, I'll play the theme music to your favorite TV show, because that'll make you kind of like, okay, calm down, breathe. This is the thing you like. You're going to be okay through the situation, which is, it's just such a sweet, a sweet way of, you know, how media calms you down and how it reassures you. And you're in a new situation
and having a comfort show
you want to go back to. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you mentioned you've re-listened to these novellas in this series more than once. I think most of us have some favorite bit of media, whether it's a TV show or a book, that we have returned to several times, and we know what's going to happen, but part of why we're turning to it is because we like that, like there's a comfort in knowing what's going to happen and revisiting whether it's the characters or the author's prose style or like familiar jokes in a sitcom. Like, we know re-binging the same content is something that as humans we do. And I think this book actually does a really interesting job of kind of exploring why that media consumption, you know, is part of what, it's part of what makes us human, that we seek that out. And it's part of the growing humanity of this sec unit is experiencing this, that sometimes is almost like, it feels like a guilty pleasure or something that we're ashamed of when we talk about the media that we re-consume. For this sec unit that is figuring out and discovering what it means to be human, to have its comfort show that it just wants to go see the next episode of instead of having another awkward human interaction. I think that's a deeply human moment.
Yeah. Well, and the fact that, you know, it disabled its governor module, but then it just kind of kept doing its job and wasn't really sure what else to do. And so, you know, it has freedom in some senses, but it probably doesn't have enough freedom to actually, like, you know, run away from the corporation that owns it. So instead it just starts watching TV. Like, you know, it's not really sure what to do with its life. And then, you know, the ending when its contract gets purchased by Dr. Mensa throws it for even more of a loop. And that is a big theme of the first four novellas, is like trying to figure out, you know, what it wants to do. But it's like, well, I can't figure out what I want to do, so I'm just going to watch TV until I can figure out what I want to do or what I do with myself. And then one theme I wanted to bring up, looking into, you know, this series and the fandom, is that there's a significant part of the fandom that reads Murderbot as autistic. Not necessarily literally autistic in that this may exist in this world. But a lot of the, you know, the ways it feels about things and some of the things it's easier time with and has a harder time with. And I am a little hesitant when characters are interpreted as autistic and they're not literally supposed to be autistic, because I think sometimes it can fall into like stereotype territory or caricature territory. However, in this case, it is typically other autistic people who read Murderbot as autistic and who really empathize with it. So it's not people from outside that saying like, oh, you know, Murderbot must be neurodivergent. It's people who say, oh yeah, Murderbot has a hard time making eye contact. I have a hard time making eye contact. You know, Murderbot has a hard time with conversation. I have a hard time with conversation. Murderbot gets really stressed out by its emotions. I get stressed out by my emotions. And then Murderbot has a special interest, which is so common for autistic people, and its special interest is just watching TV all the time. And people have talked to Martha Wells, and she said it's also very anxious and depressed, which is something that I really couldn't bring up in the summary, but it's something that comes across in the voice. The Wells said that she herself has, you know, has a hard time with anxiety and depression. And she hasn't said that she specifically wrote Murderbot to read as autistic. I think she didn't really intend that, but she also doesn't dismiss the interpretation. But certainly the anxiety and the depression are things that she was writing from her own real experiences.
Yeah, it's something that I definitely felt. Like, I can't remember any of the specific beats, but there were moments where it felt like at least portrayals of characters on the spectrum that I've seen in other media. It felt like Murderbot was capturing some of those. And like you, there's a hesitancy for me to suddenly say, well, this character is clearly meant to be on the spectrum, because so much of my understanding of what's on the spectrum is also stereotypes in media, right? It's not my own informed research on this. And even as much as I want to be informed on that, so much of my understanding is just inherently through media that I know is often problematic when it comes to portrayals of people on the spectrum so many aspects of mental health, right? Like, media is not, doesn't have the greatest track record. And so for me to try and assign this new piece of media something based on stereotypes from other pieces of media felt really loaded, but I understand why that conversation is taking place. And I appreciate some of what you shared about, you know, this is people on the spectrum who are identifying this as well. But then there's also the layer of like, this is supposed to be like this AI, you know, human robot hybrid that is learning to be human. Like, I really didn't want to be the one to call out some idea about like, oh, she's clearly portraying this. But it is something that did stand out as I listened to the text.
And it's even, I don't remember if it's in this book or in a different book, but they kind of talk to it about, you know, do you want to be human? Do you want to move towards that? And it's even very clearly like, no, like I want to be a person, and I want to be treated like a person, but I'm not human and I don't want to be human. Like, I am something else that has some similarities, that is intelligent and self-aware. And again, you know, not to go back to Star Trek again, but I do think it's actually a really interesting point of comparison, where you do have, like, in the Next Generation, you have the android that wants to be human. And that's a wonderful story. And, you know, one that I really love. But also, like, this is a very different of, like, you know, what if because in the book, whichever one it is, they say, like, well, if you're kind of human, humans assume that you'll want to be fully human. Murderbot's like, well, that's stupid. Why would I want that? You know? And so
like I see so many flaws in the humans around me. I do not want to function like that.
And it's, you know, it's a good reminder that if someone is different from you in ways that make their life difficult, saying, well, you should just be like me, is maybe not the appropriate response. Maybe the appropriate response is, you know, how do we accommodate you? How do we interact with you in a way that's appropriate for you, right? Because it's really easy to be like, well, just be like me and then everything will be fine. And it's like, well, okay, but, you know, what if that wasn't the rule? And then, you know, in later books, characters who know Murderbot well, when they're talking to it, they don't try to make eye contact because they know that makes Murderbot stressed out. And so they accommodate that, and they, you know, and that's one of the really lovely things about preservation as a society, is that, and I don't really do well with dystopias. I'm kind of dystopian out just because real life has been pretty stressful for, you know, the last 4 or 8 or 10 years or whatever.
And also, you've been a heavy consumer of media since 9/11.
Yes. Yeah. But this is, it's such a hopeful story in the middle of a dystopia, right? And so it's about, you know, what if you had this really awful life and then you found a group of people who were willing to bend their own lives around you to try to help you and support you? And that's just a really lovely story and a really hopeful story. And, you know, this is a sci-fi world, but I think I really have actually learned quite a bit about assumptions I'm making about different people from these books, of like, okay, I'm assuming you're like me, or you want to be like me, or you should be like me, or you ought to be like me. And maybe that's just an underlying assumption that I have. And maybe I need to step back from that and say, no, what do you want? And I don't have to understand it, but I can, you know, make space for that and make accommodations, and I don't have to force everything into the way I think things should be, or social assumptions, in order to, you know, in order to make a world in which we can both function and both reach our, you know, reach our greatest potential.
All right, I feel like I need to say something to our listeners right now. This is completely unintended, but you may be listening, if I don't change the schedule, and because I'm saying this, I'm probably not going to, you may be listening to this episode immediately after you've heard us discuss Measure of a Man from Star Trek The Next Generation.
Oh, no.
Data's quest to become human.
Wonderful.
These episodes were put on the schedule before I even knew what Murderbot was. Like, I just had on the slot Book with Kirsta and happened to have recorded an episode about Data and Star Trek, The Next Generation.
Oh,
for release, before I even knew what this book was going to be about. So it's going to feel like we're on a major AI humanity kick for back to back weeks. And that was completely unintended. And well, it wasn't until Kirsta started mentioning that episode of Star Trek did I realize, oh, those might actually, let me go look at the schedule. Oh, they are scheduled to release back to back.
That's amazing. I love it.
Now, we're recording this a full month and a half before this episode's even going to drop. So maybe I'll switch it. But now that I've said all this, I kind of have to keep them back to back, I think.
No, yeah. It's funny. Often we have to pretend that we're not recording things back to back. And in this case, we sort of have to acknowledge that we didn't record something back to back, but it's going to come out back to back. So it's going to look like, you know, it was just like AI I was on a kick or something.
Yes. Oh, You had mentioned, like, some people read this character as, you know, on the spectrum. I will also just, like, one thing that stood out to me is just a deeply introverted character for Murderbot, right? Where, like, almost after social interaction, they need to go and recharge. You know, it needs to go to its quarters and just be away from people for a bit. And that it finds, it's for hyper extroverted people, like, your mental health is improved by those kinds of, you know, by social interactions. And for introverted people, yeah, it's like, no, I need time alone in order to rebalance.
It's such a funny moment when, you know, because the preservation team is so nice and they're trying to be so nice. And it's like, hey, come hang out with us. And Murderbot is like, that is the last thing on earth I want to do. And it shows on its face. And then it freaks out that they can tell that it doesn't want to spend time with them. But yeah, and even, you know, even the idea that you might try to do something very nice to for someone, and that might not be what they need or what they want. And you need to be willing to grow from that and reevaluate things and not get mad about it and just say, okay, we tried something and that was not a good fit and we'll try something else, you know?
Yeah. It's SecUnit struggles with the humans that are around it, and they are trying so hard to meet its needs, but they don't understand its needs. And so often they are adding stress through their intended kindness, and it makes it for a very interesting relationship that's being set up. Whereas, like, these aren't antagonists that are trying to hurt SecUnit, but very often he just wants them to stop, or it wants them to stop.
Yes. Yeah, the moment when Rati starts asking questions that are too personal, and Mensa gets mad at Rati, and then Rati's like, I'll go apologize. Mensa's like, no, that is the opposite of helpful. But yeah, and you know, we've maybe all had someone in our life who had very good intentions, but was stressful for us to be around for some reason, or kind of, you know, unintentionally made things worse. And it's like, okay, well, they sure are trying, but they are not succeeding at what they are trying to do.
On the whole, I just gotta say, like, this consuming this first novella, I did it very quickly. I thoroughly enjoyed the writing style. Like, Martha Wells has a very engaging tone that she establishes.
Yeah.
And it does, like I mentioned earlier, when we were talking about, like, the act of adaptation, like, someone's going to have to decide, like, what that alien fauna looks like. I didn't mind that it was left ambiguous. Like, I followed everything that I needed from the scene was there. And it wasn't, like, a weakness that it wasn't hyper detailed. It's just, when you're going to display something on screen, some artist is going to have to decide what that fauna looks like. But that kind of, I mean, you mentioned world building, like, the world building is so interior to SecUnit that I have a sense of what the base is like. And some of that is just my familiarity with the sci-fi genre. I have a sense of what this alien world would feel like. And again, some of that may be me just layering past, you know, visual cues from films or heavier descriptions from other sci-fi novels. But I didn't need it for this. It was, like, just the right amount. And it did leave so much of the focus on SecUnit's interior life, and choosing that balance was clearly a very deliberate choice by Martha Wells that I think she really, really nailed.
Yeah. And she does a very good job of kind of giving you breadcrumbs of world building as you need them. And so she'll be, you know, it'll be like, you know, Murderbot will say, like, well, if my governor module was intact, then I couldn't have done this thing, but I can do this thing, but I can't tell them I don't have this thing. You know, it just fills out just enough information before you need to know it. That you're like, okay, that's why this has to be this way. Oh, okay. You know, there is someone else on the planet, but they're clear on the other side. So we haven't talked to them yet, right? Or, you know, there is a satellite and there is an emergency beacon, but then this other thing happened. And so, and you know, I don't know her writing process enough to know if that was all there from the beginning, if she went back and put it in. It's a novella. She does not have a lot of time to do a lot of world building. And that's just not how this story lends itself. But yeah, it's really just little breadcrumbs. And also, like, Murderbot doesn't know everything about the world. There's also, I didn't get to this in my summary either, but there's also a point where, you know, they're trying to figure out the situation. They're trying to figure out what's happening. And Murderbot asked them kind of directly, like, well, would your home planet care if you died? Like, how invested are they in you? And they just, like, stare at it, because it turns out that Dr. Mensa is the president of their home planet. But in their charter, you have to keep doing your job. And so, like, when the, you know, when the evil survey team threatens her, they're unexpectedly threatening this very high planetary leader. But Murderbot doesn't know that because, you know, it didn't bother to read the bios of the people who were going to be its clients that time.
Doesn't and it care. Is that very much protect kind them of, the same no matter yeah. what. Right. It didn't yeah. matter. Mm-hmm. And he'd yeah. rather or it would rather watch Sanctuary Moon than read the bios of the people yeah. that he's protecting.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Well, Kirsta, do you have any final thoughts about All Systems Red, this novella?
If you like science fiction with a wry, humorous tone and a very sweetheart, I definitely recommend this either as audiobook or in print. Like I said, I've mainly listened to them on audiobook, and I found them perfectly accessible that way. Being in first person and being novellas, I think, really helps, because the stories are just not that complex and it's told in first person anyway. So, yep, highly recommended.
Yeah, and I will just second that recommendation. Thank you again, Kirsta, for coming on to the Protagonist Podcast and for suggesting another great piece of media that I was not familiar with beforehand. It is always a delight to find out about new media because of this podcast. That
I'm
is
always
wrap
very
up this
proud when I can do that. Sorry.
Yeah, you. I think consistently, like, I'll reach out and say, hey, I'm thinking about doing an episode on this thing. And you often come back like, well, what about this? I'm like, I don't know it. Let's do it. So,
yeah.
That is going to wrap up this episode. Thank you for joining us, listeners. For show notes and links to all the other great Dueling Genre shows, you can go to duelinggenre.com. Also, please subscribe to the Protagonist Podcast in your podcast app of choice, and please leave us a review. That really helps us out. We'd like to thank Scott Tofty, who composed our theme music. Thank you again for listening. We'll be back next week to discuss another great character and a great story. So long. Wait, so you're saying that we've been spoiling you by having you as a regular guest on our very professional podcast over here?
You run a tight ship, and you're prepared, and you record things well, and I'm just very impressed with the whole endeavor. So I it is a pleasure to be a guest, and I should not take that lightly, because there's a lot of work that goes on to make it a good experience.
Oh, well, thank you. I hit record. I caught that. Oh, maybe Andrew will use that for the outro on this episode. We'll just have to see.